And so that's, you know, where I start. I left off last time with step one, which was basically how crazy I was and how I did not really think I was crazy. I grew up with, let's say, fancied self-sufficiency. Some of you guys have heard me, you know, tell my story before, so I was adopted when I was 6 years old, and then when I was in seventh grade, I went to live in a foster home, and then I went and lived in another foster home, and then I was reunited with my biological family when I was a senior in high school and moved down here. So, and I don't expect any of that to be really common to anybody else particularly, but I do expect that you guys understand the fear, the anxiety, the where do I fit in, the who can I count on, I don't feel quite right, I don't know what I'm doing here, I should be in a different state, I shouldn't be in this class, I should be in a different class. I don't think I can count on any other human being, because they're just really not going to be there. And I think you guys know what'll help alleviate that feeling kind of a lot. If you drink a whole lot, you'll kind of forget about that. If you happen to mix it with some other stuff like I did, kind of helps a little bit more. So I had a whole resistance to other people and to God as well, right? Because for me, that was sort of like evidence that either there was no God, or if there was a God, God was unfair and maybe didn't really care about me. And of course, I looked at other things. Part of this experience led me to be exposed to different religions based on like who I was living with and what they were going through. And I did find a lot of hypocrisy as well. So I'm looking at their hypocrisy, right? But I'm not ever looking at my own hypocrisy. I'm looking at, like, this isn't fair, I didn't get promoted again, he's making more money than me, all this stuff, right? And it all makes perfect sense to me. So I was propelled to come into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous by family, friends, a shrink, my job, my friends. And I was pretty resistant, right? Who wants to end up here? I didn't realize that it would be like, you know, a really good thing. And when I came into the rooms, I heard from people just like you guys who said, like, yeah, I used to drink too much, and I got in trouble with my family and my friends and my job, and now I don't. And these people were really happy, and they had like a sense of ease about them. They always had time to talk to me and to listen to me. They were like relaxed. They seemed to, you know, they seemed to have it going on. They were like all successful in their businesses. So they had that attraction about them. And they would just like, you know, come in, hey, how you doing? Nobody really pressed me for anything. They might be like, you know, hopefully we'll see you tomorrow. I was kind of like, yeah, you know, I don't know if I want to commit to that much, but maybe. So, and I hadn't really decided, you know, for sure that I was an alcoholic. I may be a problem drinker or bipolar or manic depressive or just terminally unique. So unique, right? Because who has that story that I already told you? You'd be nervous too, right? Like I think you guys probably were. So there were who called it the other day? Called this a grown-up meeting, I think it was. The meetings I went to, fortunately, were mostly some grown-up people. There were people who were like, you know, you don't have to believe anything. Can you believe that I believe? Can I believe that you believe? Hey, if you say so. It's working for you. You seem to be sober. You seem to be happy. You seem to be showing up here regularly. You got something going on. I don't know what it is. Can I believe that you believe? Sure. I'll take that, you know, I'll take that little creep forward. So I was open-minded enough to see what was going on around me in a group of people with some long-term, solid, loving, service-oriented sobriety. It was freaking awesome. It was amazing. I lived in Hollandale at the time, and I worked in a country club. And what I used to do prior to about this step was finish, you know, have a drink or two at work prior to leaving work, and then go get hammered for the rest of the night, whether this bar or that bar. And whoever was there, that was cool, and somebody would always be there. And then I would go home and cry myself to sleep, usually while watching Leaving Las Vegas, and feel sorry for myself about what a lonely, unfair, pathetic existence it was, and how I squandered my potential, and all that BS. Potential was a big freaking word I heard all the time. Like, you know, if you'd only, you know, stop doing shots, you have so much potential, and you should be, you know, you should be a general manager by now, or whatever. Like, alcohol really, you know, stomped on my potential. So because of this group that I went to, I started saying the Serenity Prayer in meetings. I got a phone list. I talked to other people who understood that I was freaking petrified to even be around. And I made choices, like when I wanted to drink, and I wanted to drink all the time. At one point, somebody said to me, do you think you drink too much? And I said, oh my God, are you kidding me? I don't think I drink enough. I should be wasted all the time. Life is like, oh my God, it's just it's like a pressure cooker. So I started to think that maybe there was a possibility for me to want to drink and not drink. And you guys gave me the tools on how to do that, which was pray, call another alcoholic, go to a meeting. So I actually put more effort into that than I did. Like some people say, you know, put as much effort into your recovery as you did into your drinking. So I was actually pretty lazy about my drinking. It was at work, there was some booze, I would drink it. Then I would go to local establishment and drink some more and then go on home, which conveniently usually had a lot of booze in it, and drink until I was unconscious. So I would get on the phone after work. I would get through those times of being at work, wanting to drink, and not drinking, go in the ladies' room, say the Serenity Prayer, make a phone call, and get out of there. And drive from Hollandale to the old West Broward Club, which was at that time like off hiatus and out west. And usually, sometimes I would talk to somebody all the way there. And that's like, you know, 30 minute drive, whatever. Talk some, like, I, you know, I'm tense, I don't feel right, I want to drink, I always drink. You're like, well, you know, just come on out, maybe you'll catch the end of the meeting. Go have some coffee with us afterwards. So for me, in the very beginning, the fellowship is what helped me basically have faith again. And it was by testing, right? It was. So I said, you know, God, Jesus, Mormons, Christians, whatever, you know, I don't know. I've seen some of you in action. You know, war, religious wars, killing, money, greed, adultery, all this, like, yeah, I don't think so. But when I tested that myself, like, it was just a try. Just try it. try saying a prayer. Try saying one little short prayer. Like, I was seriously defiant, you guys. I really was. Try saying one short prayer, make a phone call, and just see what happens. Well, you know, okay. And then they said, why don't you see if you can do this for 90 days? 90 days, that's like forever, right? They said, last time I know I talked about the white chip. So I aimed for the 90-day chip, right? He said, if you want your misery back after 90 days, you can have it back. All that you have right now, you can have it back. Okay. Because as bad as everything sucked for me, I was still very reluctant to, like, let it go. Because I knew it. It was like that misery loves company thing, or you know, it's comfortable, it's a known, it sucks, but it's like a, you know it, you know how it's going to go, you know who's going to be at the dive bar, except, you know, sometimes there were the things that you don't know, like what was that bumping I heard on my way home last night? I guess I better go check the car and see if there's any, like, you know, blood on it. And that's a pretty freaking, you know, scary thought when you operate your life like that. And I operated my life like that. And those times were the times that, you know, I did like the foxhole prayers. And I came to approach the concept of God differently. Later on, I came to understand things like be quick to see where religious people are right. Wait a minute. Sometimes they're right. Oh, a lot of times they're right. A lot of times people are coming over to this church and, like, minding their own business and helping people. Oh, yeah, okay. Oh, those people who took me into their house when I was a kid and my parents were unstable, and those were good church-going people, and those were some of the best years of my life. And I guess that was a pretty right way of living, wasn't it? So it really was a matter of my perspective. And then I came to think about, God, how God allowed us. Hi, how you doing? How God allowed us free will. So I think God really wants the best for each of us individually and collectively, right? But he can't just, he or she or it, whatever. He doesn't just make us that way, right? Like, we're not robots. We choose to do it. Somebody asked me to do this meeting. I said, okay. Suiting up and showing up for me is part of doing God's will. And we need to agree to that because we have free will. So just as we can agree to do that or disagree to do that or know the right thing and do the wrong thing anyway, that's, to me, like, that's God's faith in us. And what we do with that has to do more with us than with God. And, you know, we're a fallible bunch. And especially in AA, you know, we have an illness. We have that mental craziness that is so relieved by, you know, courage in a bottle or whatever it is. For me in particular, and I'm not speaking for all of AA. For me in particular, I mix that with some other things because, you know, hey, why not? So I didn't realize that in my quest to try these other things, such as Jägermeister, Absolut and soda, pills, powder, that all of that actually was a higher power already. So that already was a higher power. I was already devoting hours of my life. I was certainly tithing way more than 10%, more like 90% of my income to the God of alcohol. And yet you guys came in and you talked to me about God. I'm like, oh God, I don't know what this God thing is. I don't, that devotion and blah, blah. And I I that's how it really was. And then I came to see it a little bit differently. So I do want to read just a couple things out of step two. And this writing is just perfect for all of us. You know, it's about the defiance. It's about the fellowship. You have convinced us that we are alcoholics and that our lives are unmanageable. Having reduced us to a state of absolute helplessness, you now declare that none but a higher power can remove our obsession. So, and some of you guys know my sister was just recently hospitalized basically for alcoholism. And this is the whole argument from my family is, but you know, I hear it's kind of a religious thing. I hear there's some religion involved in it. She was in a hospital for 10 freaking days because of her organs are failing. And AA has helped people over the years recover from a hopeless state of mind and body. But you know what? There's a freaking religious element to it, maybe. Maybe. Nobody told me what thing to believe in. They said, you know what? You can believe that I believe. Can you believe that I can believe? Sure, I believe that. You can write whatever conception of God you want. You can have it be the group. If you want to, you can have it be a doorknob. Preferably, it's not the Jägermeister and it's not the Absolut and Soda anymore. It can be the old guy in the sky. It can be Mother Nature. It can be something else. It needs to be something else. But, you know, I do remember where I came from. Another crowd of AA says, we were plumb disgusted with religion and all its works. The Bible was full of nonsense. We could cite it chapter and verse, and we couldn't see the Beatitudes for the begats. In spots, its morality was impossibly good. In others, it seemed impossibly bad. But it was the morality of the religionists themselves that really got us down. We gloated over the hypocrisy, bigotry, and crushing self-righteousness that clung to so many believers, even in their Sunday best. How we loved to shout the damaging fact that millions of the good men of a religion were still killing one another off in the name of God. Right? Like, isn't that pretty much what I just said? And they already wrote it, like, what, 50, 60 years ago? Why the literature is just so perfect, I think, for the way that I think. You know, I always thought I was like alone in the universe until I picked up this book, which, by the way, someone in the fellowship gave me of the kindness of their heart. I said, oh, why don't you check this book out a little bit? To clergymen, doctors, friends, and families, the alcoholic who means well and tries hard is a heartbreaking riddle. To most AAs, he is not. There are too many of us who have been just like him and have found the riddle's answer. The answer has to do with the quality of faith rather than its quantity. This has been our blind spot. We supposed we had humility when really we hadn't. We had been asking something for nothing. The fact was we really hadn't cleaned house so that the grace of God could enter us and expel the obsession. In no deep or meaningful sense had we ever taken stock of ourselves, made amends to those we had harmed, or freely given to any other human being without any demand for reward. We had not even prayed rightly. We had always said, grant me my wishes instead of thy will be done. The love of God and man we understood not at all. Therefore, we remained self-deceived and so incapable of receiving enough grace to restore us to sanity. So fortunately for me, I was basically loved until I could learn to love myself and learn to love God and be open enough to go on to step three. And with that, I'll stop.